Let's cultivate our motivation. So whenever we say the word I and think of ourselves, there's an image of some ordinary person there who is this nationality, this race, this religion, this socioeconomic class, this education level, this gender orientation, and on and on and on. The person who likes this, who doesn't like that, the I that is insecure, the I that nobody likes, the I that doesn't like anybody else, you know, that's that kind of very ordinary, afflicted person appears to our mind whenever we think of ourselves. And yet we possess this amazing potential to become a fully awakened Buddha. But when we think of ourselves, we seldom think of that potential. So there's a whole aspect of ourselves, the aspect of our incredible potential that we don't see, that we neglect, that we sometimes even doubt if it's there at all. So our vision of ourselves is really quite restricted, quite limited, and limiting. Because when we think of ourselves as only an ordinary afflicted being, that's how we always act. If we think of ourselves as a being who has the potential to become a Buddha, then there's a chance that we may act more in line with that potential, become more mindful of our ethical conduct, how we feel about other sentient beings and how we treat them. And even the nature of reality. So it's important to remember this potential, work to develop it, and recognize that every other living being has this same potential too. And if we see others like that, then we don't deprecate anybody. We don't give up on anybody. So with this kind of perspective, let's turn our mind towards the aspiration to gain full awakening so that we can be of the greatest benefit to all these other living beings who have the Buddha potential, but who don't necessarily see it. Imagine what it would be like if you walked around all day being aware of your own potential and other people's potential. Yeah. Wouldn't your life be different? Okay. So we're in the last chapter of the book. The chapter is called Working in the World. And so far in this chapter, what have we discussed? Good health and dealing with injury and illness, and maintaining a positive attitude. And now we're on the section using diverse methods to benefit others. And so here is Holiness, we'll be getting into specific fields of activity and how we can apply the Dharma in those activities. Okay, so he says, as limited beings, we may find it difficult to know what is beneficial for others. Do you have that problem? Yeah. I mean, sometimes we lack the compassion. We don't really want to help. We'd much rather do something else. Sometimes we lack the wisdom. We have no idea what to do. And sometimes we lack the capability, you know, the power or ability to enact anything. And so we just kind of sit there and feel flustered. Okay. So sometimes our prejudice, attachment, and anger color the situation. And then that makes it very difficult to harm, to help others, to benefit them, if we can't even see them in a little bit of an accurate view. Yeah. We have preconceived ideas about how others should live their lives. Yeah. Do you have preconceived ideas how other people should live their lives? Yeah. We have advice for this person, for that person, for the other person, for the government, for other people's governments. Yeah. We know how everybody else should live their lives, and we're happy to give them our advice. But we're not very clear on how to live our own life. And we get really confused. So the first step in helping others is clearing away the afflictions and self-preoccupation from our own mind. Because as long as our minds are always focused, me, me, what's happening to me, what's my experience, what's going on in my mind, what are my emotions, do people think of me, do they like me, do they hate me, do I fit in, do I belong, am I as intelligent as they are, am I less intelligent, am I as artistic or less artistic, or how do I fit in and relate to all these other people, and our minds just constantly thinking, me, 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 I, yeah? With that kind of mind, how in the world can we benefit anybody else? We can't even see them. Yeah? Or if we try and see them, all we do is see our projections. Yeah? Based on superficial attributes that they may have. And, you know, so we have lots of opinions about people we've never even met or never even talked to. Okay? And then we come and sit down on the cushion and say, may I be of great benefit to all living beings. You know, it's like we can't even see beyond our own nose. It's really kind of strange, isn't it? Kind of funny. Okay, so first we have to clear away all that stuff, the self-preoccupation, the afflictions. Second, we actively cultivate love, compassion, and courage in order to have the inner strength to be of assistance. Yeah? So we need love, compassion, that's going to give us the willingness to engage with others and to help them, and inner strength so that when we, you know, try and do something to benefit others, we don't give up after 2 minutes. We don't, you know, burst into tears when they don't want our help. You know, we don't feel offended. Oh, I tried so hard to help that person and they didn't want my help. you know. So we instead, we develop some inner strength to be able to endure all that. And third, we develop the wisdom to determine the most skillful way to help. At this point, we may practice the four types of awakening activity: peace, increase, control, and wrath. So you may have heard about these sometimes in the different deity practices, developing these four activities of peace, increase, control or influence, and wrath. So initially we practice these in meditation. First imagining, we always start with peace. Okay, so we imagine pacifying the afflictions of others by encouraging them to purify their negativities. Okay, and then second one, we imagine increasing their lifespan, wisdom, and merit by inspiring them to act constructively. So, for example, if you're doing 35 Buddhas or the Vajrasattva practice, and you imagine other living beings around you, and you think that they're bowing together with you, confessing their negativities, determining not to do them again, then that's the first one of pacifying. And then when you do practices such as White Tara, where you imagine all the sentient beings at your heart and light and nectar flowing into them, increasing their lifespan, their wisdom, and their merit. Okay, so different practices emphasize different aspects, different of these four activities. Okay. Next, we imagine being able to influence or control their afflictions through the force of our wisdom and compassion. Okay, so we want to be able to have strong influence on others in a good way. Sometimes it's translated as control, but it doesn't mean control somebody like we usually think of control, where, you know, I'm going to control you and you're not free. It means really influence others and set up the circumstances where you can really help them go in a good direction. And then finally, for those sentient beings who are intractable, we imagine employing wrathful means to destroy their ability to harm others. So it always goes in this order. You never start with wrathful means. You always start with peaceful, then increase, then influence. And if nothing else works, then the wrathful one. To apply these four in an actual situation, let's take the example of someone who is about to perform some act of cruelty. A bodhisattva who lacks clairvoyant powers and thus doesn't know exactly what is best to do in the situation begins with peaceful means. She uses gentle methods to intercede, pacifying that person by giving comfort, verbally addressing his concerns, or using reason to dissuade him from harming someone. Okay. If that doesn't work, okay, then this bodhisattva tries increasing his well-being. She may give him a gift or medicine or teach him a topic that interests him. If this too doesn't work, then she progresses. She will use strong pressure or influence to try to steer him in a good direction. Should that too fail, she may intimidate the person through aggressive means or destroy his ability to harm others. Such forceful action must be motivated by compassion, not by vengeance, and is used only as a last resort. Okay. So the basic approach here is to apply whatever techniques are most effective to relieve our own or others' difficulties. This is consistent with the advice that there is nothing a bodhisattva should not learn. So we hear that advice a lot, don't we? You know, it's like, do I have to learn engineering? Yeah. So, well, at least a little bit. Okay. So we don't use just the Dharma to prevent or solve our own or others' problems, but We also eat a healthy diet, exercise, and use whatever type of medical treatment is suitable. Okay, so some people think whenever there's a problem with ourselves, with others, you know, we should just apply Dharma things, okay? But here is Holiness is saying, no, you know, we have to take care of ourselves and take care of others in a variety of ways, okay? So you may take vitamins, okay? That doesn't mean taking vitamins is a Buddhist practice, but being a Buddhist doesn't preclude you from taking vitamins, okay? So he says, complementing Buddhist practice with other methods is fine, although it is wise to remember they are distinct fields. Okay, so we can use other methods to help ourselves or to help other beings. Yeah, if we see somebody sick, yeah, we may first, you know, help them by taking them to the doctor and getting them some medicine, and then afterwards maybe teaching them some Dharma if they're interested. Okay. For example, if Buddhists have Buddhists have issues that psychotherapy can help solve, they can and should enter therapy. Dharma centers could have counselors who are also Dharma students. Students would not regard the counselors as spiritual teachers, but could discuss psychological issues with them. I am happy to hear that some Buddhists are developing Buddhist-based psychotherapeutic methods. Okay, so here he's acknowledging, you know, that Buddhist practice, you know, it may not be what everybody needs at any particular time. Okay, that some people, you know, before they can practice, if they're sick, they need to get well. If they have therapeutic, you know, mental issues, they have to resolve those. Some of these things, of course, can happen at the same time you're practicing Dharma. You know, you can be ill and practice Dharma and get your medical treatment. You can practice the Dharma and be in therapy at the same time. So he's saying, don't be limited in how you care for yourself or how you care for others. And so he's really saying too here, you know, that it's good if Dharma centers have counselors, but the counselors or the therapists are not seen as Buddhist teachers, okay? Because therapy and Buddhist practice are quite different, okay? They have different worldviews, they have different aims. Of course, you know, there's certain amount of overlap, you know. They're both working for psychological well-being. But, you know, Buddhism is looking at multiple lifetimes. It's talking about spiritual freedom. Therapy is talking about well-being in this particular life. Okay. Therapy will accept a certain amount of anger and afflictions, just not the amount that causes trouble in somebody's life. Whereas in Buddhism, we're striving to get rid of all of our afflictions altogether. When I lived in Seattle, we had two conferences, Buddhism and psychotherapy, Buddhism and psychology conferences. We did them at UW. And they were really interesting because we had Buddhist practitioners, we had people who were therapists and from the psych department, people who knew a little bit of both, and really interesting discussions and kind of a comparing and contrasting of the two. I think it was very, very helpful. Okay, be nice to maybe do that in Spokane. Yeah, something like that. So His Holiness continues, from one viewpoint, anything can be considered Buddhist if it is motivated by bodhicitta. However, just because a practice is done by a Buddhist does not necessarily make it a Buddhist practice. Okay? So, you know, if we generate bodhicitta, we can turn anything into our spiritual practice. But it doesn't mean that just because we're a Buddhist, everything we do is spiritual practice, because we have afflictions, yeah. And as I always remind people, not all Buddhists are Buddhas. So don't expect Buddhists to act like Buddhas, you know. Maybe a few of them will, but the rest of us, you know, are ordinary beings. Okay. For example, to attain liberation, a Buddhist must practice serenity meditation. But this, in and of itself, is not a Buddhist practice, because practitioners of other traditions do it as well. Yeah, it's very interesting, as many people, when they first come to the Dharma, I want to go on shamatha retreat. You know, I want to do long-term shamatha retreat and gain shamatha. And then you say, but shamatha isn't a Buddhist practice. Yeah, they're quite surprised, because it's a practice in many other spiritual traditions. Yeah, so it's a Buddhist practice if you do it with a mind that has taken refuge, and with a mind that is looking or seeking either liberation or awakening. That will make shamatha into a Buddhist practice. But just developing concentration. You know, the Hindus do that, some of the Christians do that. It's not strictly a Buddhist practice. Okay. I was with His Holiness one time, and he was talking about even some of the practices you do in Tantra, working with the subtle energies and the subtle body. The Hindus do the same practices. And he was giggling because he said, oh, all these people think that they're doing something so special, but they're doing the same thing that the Hindus do. You know, of course, you know, he was hoping that they did them with bodhicitta and an understanding of emptiness and so on. But he was, you know, kind of joking that if you don't understand the basic Buddhist framework, you know, you can be doing these practices and they're thinking that you're a high-class Buddhist or high-level Buddhist, but they aren't Buddhist practices because your mind doesn't have the right motivation and you're not doing the rest of the Buddhist practice. Okay. Similarly, except for insight into impermanence and selflessness, insight in and of itself cannot be called Buddhist, because non-Buddhists also practice it. So there you have two of the pillars of the path, serenity and insight. And he's saying, with the exception of having insight into emptiness and selflessness, you know, and neither of them are strictly Buddhist practices. The rest of your mind has to make them into Buddhist practices with your motivation, with your perspective on the ultimate nature, with your renunciation. Techniques from disciplines such as psychotherapy can be adopted by Buddhists, but that does not make these techniques Buddhist. Okay, so there was I don't know how much it's happening now, but before there was a big movement of, you know, adopting a lot of psychotherapy therapeutic practices in the Buddhist community. And His Holiness is saying, you know, it's fine, you know, to take vitamins and, you know, practice therapy and everything, but that doesn't necessarily make these things Buddhist practice, okay? But it's interesting, Tibetan culture, they took things like mos and different divinations that were not Buddhist, and they made them into Buddhist practice in Tibet. Yeah. It's interesting how that happens. Okay, so from this viewpoint, the only techniques or practices that can specifically be called Buddhist are those directly relating to the goal of liberation from cyclic existence, For example, the meditation on selflessness. Okay? So from that viewpoint, what's really Buddhist practice is the meditation on selflessness. Okay? Even generating love and compassion, yeah, these are practices done in all religions. Practicing forgiveness, done in all religions. Okay? So, that we have a lot in common with other faiths, but to make these Buddhist practices, we have to have refuge, some renunciation, some bodhicitta, some idea of emptiness. Okay, then he continues, if other disciplines such as psychology or yoga do not entail believing in a permanent soul or creator, and if they make us a kinder or healthier person, we may use them. So as he's saying, if something doesn't involve holding a non-Buddhist view, then of course we can use them and practice them. If other disciplines teach beliefs that conflict with Buddhist views or create difficulties in our practice, it is wiser to leave them aside. Okay? So if you're doing some kind of, Ouija board, seances, fortune telling, these kinds of things, and you're believing in different spirits and ghosts and stuff like that. He's saying, leave that aside. That's not a Buddhist practice. Okay. So he's saying this is a general position, but there may be some exceptions. For instance, to help people with low self-esteem have a better view of themselves, teaching them there is a permanent soul may be helpful. Even the Buddha taught a permanent self in some scriptures as a skillful means to benefit a particular audience. Okay, so that may happen when you're teaching others, but in terms of what you practice, you don't want to practice anything where the beliefs directly conflict or contradict what the Buddha taught. Okay, any Buddhist teaching, such as mindfulness, compassion, or the taking and giving meditation, can be taught to others to help them. People doing so, teaching these things, should not consider themselves Buddhist teachers, nor should they call secularized versions of Buddhist practice Buddhism. Okay, so this is quite important. You may be a therapist, and you learn some kind of meditation from a Buddhist, and you're adapting it in your therapy, that doesn't make you a Buddhist teacher. Okay? And it doesn't make your secularized version of that practice Buddhism. Okay? So he's saying it's fine to take these things, adapt them to other fields, but don't consider yourself a Buddhist teacher, and don't consider your adaptation Buddhism. Because if you do and you teach things like this under the guise of Buddhism, then it's quite deceptive to people who are coming to the Dharma because they're seeking spiritual liberation, and instead they're getting taught something that is an amalgamation of Buddhism and some secular field. Okay, is this clear with people? Okay. They may simply say the technique they teach has its source in Buddhism. Okay, so this has a source in Buddhism. You don't say it is Buddhism. Not only because that could give the people the wrong idea of what is Buddhist practice, but also many people may want to try that technique that you're teaching, that you've adapted from Buddhism, but they won't do it because they think it's Buddhist practice and that you're a Buddhist teacher and they already have their own faith and they don't want to do a practice from another religion. Okay? So I think it's very important to keep what is Buddhist practice and what is our secular, you know, adaptations, to keep them quite separate. Yeah. Yeah, one of my friends in Singapore who was teaching secular mindfulness, we had quite a long discussion about this, you know, and first about the disadvantages of calling secular mindfulness Buddhism, yeah, because, you know, she was saying, then the Buddhists come and they think I'm a Buddhist teacher and I'm not, and I'm not qualified to do that, and I'm not teaching Buddhist mindfulness anyway. So that was one problem. But then she said she lived in Singapore. There are Christians there. There are Muslims there. And she said, you know, if I make it like sound like a Buddhist practice, then the Christians and the Muslims won't come and learn it. And it's something actually that they can benefit from because it's a secular practice. Okay. Although mindfulness is very popular now and is rooted in Buddha Dharma, the way it is taught and practiced in secular society differs from in a Buddhist context. The purpose of secular mindfulness is to help people live better in the present, while Buddhists meditate on the four establishments of mindfulness to attain liberation and awakening. So that you know how you meditate, what you meditate on, what your goal is, completely different in secular mindfulness and in Buddhist practice. Okay. For example, you know, in Buddhist mindfulness, if you're doing the mindfulness of the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, you're also investigating their impermanent nature, their empty nature. Okay, you're not just watching the mind and what arises in your mind and what goes away, but it's in Buddhist mindfulness, it's very much conjoined with wisdom to gain an understanding of these different things. Secular mindfulness simply observes sensation and thoughts as they arise in the body and mind. Buddhist mindfulness has an element of wisdom and leads to insight into impermanence, the nature of dukkha, and selflessness. Okay, so we have to also be careful as Buddhist teachers, you know, because His Holiness was saying, taking things that are not Buddhist and teaching them as if they were Buddhist. And so I was thinking here, I remember Jeffrey one time saying that love and compassion are in Buddhism are always taught in terms of cultivating them towards others, not towards ourselves. Yeah. So we know that in the West, many people have difficulties with loving themselves and being kind to themselves and having compassion for themselves. And in a Buddhist course, we may talk about that a little bit to, you know, in the context of helping people get rid of afflictions. But we should not think that teaching people about self-love and self-practice is a specifically Buddhist teaching. Okay? And so we, you know, if we are teaching about love and compassion, we may mention self-love, self-compassion. But our teaching should be principally about developing love and compassion for others. Okay? Because when we look in the Lam Rim, you know, when the Bodhicitta teachings, when we look at the four immeasurables, immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, they're all taught in terms of developing these attitudes towards others. Okay? But we can talk about being kind to ourselves in terms of eliminating afflictions, yeah, because those are antidotes to different afflictions that we may have. Okay, but to you know, make sure that when we teach, we aren't teaching therapy, you know, therapeutic things in the context of giving a Buddhist teaching without clearly delineating that these are more therapeutic things. Does that make some sense? Getting what I'm saying? Yeah. I was also thinking, you know, that sometimes, at least many of the therapists I know, when they talk about developing love and compassion, they may use the example first of a puppy or a kitten, you know, because it's so easy to have tender feelings for a puppy and a kitten, you know, or maybe a baby. But in Buddhism, in all the teachings, they never use those examples. So I was thinking, well, why? You know, why when the Buddha is, you know, like in the Four Immeasurables, when you talk about when you first start to generate love, you don't use a puppy or a kitten or even a friend. Yeah, you use a teacher or somebody you respect that you're not attached to. So I was thinking, well, why, you know, what's wrong with the puppy and the kitten? Well, you know, when you love a puppy or a kitten, there's something, what's the word? Not sentimental, but maudlin. Is that a word? Am I saying it right? There's something, you know, it's a different kind of feeling. And also, there's quite a difference in status between you and a puppy or a kitten. Whereas generating love and compassion, joy and altruism, you know, we start out with living beings who are human beings who have the same, we have the same status, the same level. Puppy or kitten, we look down on, we can feel sorry for, we can have sentimental feelings, but that isn't what we're trying to cultivate in Buddhism when we cultivate love and compassion. Okay? So if a person has faith in both Christianity and Buddhism, she may view Jesus as a bodhisattva and visualize him as a symbol of love and compassion. However, we can't say this is Buddhist practice. Okay. But His Holiness does say when we're with Christians, we can teach them a meditation like the meditation we do on the Buddha, but tell them to visualize Jesus, you know? And that's a skillful way because the Buddhist meditation on the Buddha, you're purifying, accumulating merit, you know, developing faith, imagining light coming into you and so on. And for somebody who's a Christian who has faith in Jesus, doing that same meditation with Jesus as you're the focal object can work really well for them. But that's not a Buddhist practice. Okay. So you may remember one of our Catholic sisters who's been a long-term friend came here in one of the 2008, was it? Yeah, she came here to do retreat in the little cabin at the end of the garden. And she wanted to meditate on Jesus as the sublime physician. So we based it on the medicine Buddha practice. Okay, except she rewrote it, you know, with the visualization of Jesus and different prayers and so on from her own tradition that she included in the sadhana. But then she did it with the light coming from Jesus purifying her and inspiring her and so forth. Yeah, and so that was really kind of cool. She benefited a lot from the retreat. Okay, but that's not a Buddhist practice. I've been in situations where I've taught Christians. One time, well, Many years ago, there were some Christian nuns who came to Dharamsala for His Holiness's teachings. So I always like meeting nuns from other traditions. So I went up and introduced myself and started talking with them. And they had their tradition was mostly cloistered. So they had some special permission to go to India and come to the teachings. But they said, you know, if you're ever on the East Coast, come and visit us. So a few years after that, I was on the East Coast and I went to visit them. And I was able to have lunch with the Mother Superior and some of the others. They let me come inside the cloister. Most other people couldn't do that, but I was a nun, so they let me go in. And then, much to my surprise, as lunch was finishing, the abbess asked me to give a Dharma talk, to her nuns. Yeah. So, okay. So I didn't have much time to prepare because it was lunch. And then, So I went in there and I started talking about developing equanimity and especially evening out attachment and anger and working with anger. These nuns got what I was saying like this, you know, because they lived in community. They had the experience of watching their minds and their reactions towards others. And it was the greatest feeling of communication, you know, because sometimes when you speak to an audience, you don't know if you're actually getting through. They all kind of sit there like this, and, you know, hello, you know, are you interested in this? But those sisters were really on it. And it was so cool. It was really good. Yeah. So that kind of thing, I think, is really helpful to do. Okay. We can teach Buddhist principles to the general public without using specifically Buddhist language and without calling these concepts Buddhist. So that's the best thing to do with your old friends and with your family, because there's so much of Buddhism that is just common sense. You don't have to use Sanskrit words or Pali words or any weird, you know, mystical concepts. You know, because all the thought turning teachings, for example, I mean, they're just kind of common sense. And you can teach them in just regular old words, regular vocabulary, and give examples, and people can get it, whether they're Buddhist or not. And so that can be really helpful for other people. However, we should not incorporate non-Buddhist practices or concepts into Buddhism and call them Buddhism. This harms the existence of the pure Dharma. So then the next section is engaged Buddhism and political involvement. Oh, political involvement. Guess what's happening in the country? Yeah. So His Holiness starts this out. I have some reservations speaking about politics, the business world, and so forth, because I don't want it to appear that I have advice regarding each and every field, especially those in which my knowledge is limited. Yeah, so some of these things in the remaining sections, I had to really ask for and get his ideas, because he really did not want to appear to be an expert in everything. Yeah. I also do not want my personal opinions on these topics to be seen as the Buddhist view to which all Buddhists must adhere. So I will simply discuss general points about motivation and so forth and leave their application to the reader. Okay, so again, he doesn't want, when he's offering an opinion, he says it's opinion. He doesn't want people to see his personal opinions as the Buddha's word, or for people to feel that if they're going to be a Buddhist, they have to go along with all of his ideas and opinions about all topics. Okay, so this is important for us to understand, because sometimes as the students looking at our teachers, and when we're taught to have very high regard for our teachers, you know, or sometimes even to see them as an enlightened being, then we may get the idea that everything our teacher says about any topic, yeah, must be correct, and we should follow the teacher's instruction and think the same way. And so here's His Holiness saying, no, don't do that. Yeah, okay, so I'm just saying my opinion, yeah, and but you think for yourself and you apply it yourself. Okay. So I think this is much better, because otherwise, especially when we're working cross-culturally, our teachers belong to one culture and we belong to another. You know, there's some real differences in views, in attitudes, in how you communicate different things. And to think that we have to hold every one of our teachers' ideas about any topic whatsoever as our own, you know, in order to be a faithful student is not right at all, okay? And so, you know, that's one reason that we don't tell people who to vote for, you know, and why I think in Christian churches they shouldn't tell people who to vote for either, yeah? Because these are, you know, things that people can make their own personal decision on, yeah? So many of you have heard, you know, one of my teachers who I totally adore, who's helped me so much, thought George W. Bush was an excellent president. Okay, why? Because Bush talked to China about human rights, and the Tibet issue involved human rights. And because Bush was a strong leader against, you know, at 9-1-1, he was a strong leader after 9-1-1. So my teacher thought that was good. Most of his disciples kind of thought, you know, like, huh? Okay. But, you know, none of us were going to change our ideas. And we also realized that trying to tell Geshe-la this was useless. Yeah. And so anyway, we came there to learn Madhyamaka philosophy, not to learn, you know, political you know, parties and, you know, what makes a good president. And, you know, so if you have those ideas, then you can function very well and not think that you have to adapt everything that you may not believe in. So one of my friends, she was very disturbed because, you know, some of our Tibetan teachers don't believe in gender equity, you know, and, you know, does that mean that we too have to, you know, have that attitude towards women? No, it doesn't mean that at all. This is a cultural belief that comes from their culture. It is not a Buddhist belief adopting is going to bring us closer to awakening. Yeah. So this has been a puzzle, actually, among many Western Buddhists, because sometimes we think, you know, we like Buddhist ideas so much and we apply them to political and social issues that are important to us, and they seem to fit very, very well. Yeah. But then we find some of our teachers have totally different views about those political and social issues. Yeah. And so I know for the Zen people, there was one time when they were really questioning how could so many of our Roshis have supported the Japanese imperial government during World War II. You know, if you know anything about Japan's role in World War II, the army was horrible. The human rights abuses were dreadful. And yet many of these people were taught Buddhism. And so the Zen people were saying, well, how could they act that way and follow the instructions of the Japanese government and still believe in Buddhism? So it's a puzzle. It's a puzzle, you know, because, you know, we look at Buddhist ideas and apply them and want reach one conclusion according to our cultural background. They apply Buddhist ideas to their cultural background and come up with something else. Or maybe they don't apply the Buddhist ideas at all. Yeah, and that in their way of thinking, there's culture and there's Buddhism, and they don't apply what they learn in Buddhism to cultural things. I don't know. I can't describe how people think. I do see sometimes people take, in the West, people taking Buddhist ideas and twisting them so that they correspond with their views on social or political issues. When my understanding of those same Buddhist ideas, I would not come to that same conclusion about those social and political issues. Yeah. So I don't know if people just twist it, if they ignore it, if they apply it but get a different conclusion. I don't know. Of course, I think I'm completely free of any cultural overlays in my Buddhist practice. And I, you know, apply all of the Dharma principles exactly as the Buddha meant them without distorting them at all. Okay. But these other people, I don't know if they really do like that. Okay. And they probably think the same thing about me. Yeah. And they might be right. But yeah. Because sometimes we cannot see our own cultural biases. Yeah. I remember one time I was quite new to Buddhism. I'm telling a lot of stories tonight. But they illustrate the points. So I was living at Koppan, and they were having some difficulties with some of the local people sometimes coming in and stealing small things from the monastery. So they were building a big wall around, and I saw one of the lamas gluing glass shards on top of the wall, you know, to keep the local villagers out. And I'm going, a llama is putting glass shards on top of a wall to keep these poor villagers out? How is that indicative of love and compassion? I was really horrified. Okay. But of course, you know, that llama didn't think twice about it. And for him, you know, he was probably thinking, you know, stealing from the three jewels, people create horrendous negative karma. So if he can prevent them from stealing, he's actually saving them from committing that karma. Okay. But that didn't enter my mind, because I had the idea of, if you were a Buddhist who love all sentient beings, you should never put glass shards on top of a wall. Okay? Just as, you know, these are all things when I was baby Buddhist. When I saw one of my Western monk friends reading a Newsweek or Time magazine, I was totally scandalized. You know, what is he reading Newsweek, Time for? That's just secular rubbish. Why is he wasting his time? He should be meditating and purifying and prostrating, and he's reading Newsweek instead, you know. Yeah. So, you know, this is where my mind was at. and, you know, how I apply Buddhist ideas. And I thought, okay, this is, you know, the way you must apply Buddhist ideas, and there's no other way. Yeah. Then one of my other teachers, who was this teacher, for sure he realized emptiness. This one was amazing, amazing teacher. And I was the cook. This was in America. He was visiting America for a few months. So I was cooking, but he and then the Geshe from the Dharma Center, they would watch TV in the evenings. I mean, sometimes they would do puja, but sometimes they would watch TV. What are they watching TV for? All this horrible, junky stuff. You know, and then my teacher commented one time that it's a very good thing for image for illusory-like appearances. Yeah, because when you see something on TV, you think it's a real person. You get, you know, attachment comes up, anger comes up, just like it's a real person. Yeah, it's just like the illusory-like appearances, how they can function to generate things, but they're totally false. Okay, yeah. So my point is, maybe don't be so judgmental. Okay? Okay. If someone can make significant spiritual progress, remaining isolated in retreat and spending most of her energy in deep meditation is worthwhile. However, this is difficult for most people who wish to have a family and a job. I don't. He's talking about most people. In this case, live in a balanced way, maintain a daily meditation practice of whatever length is practical for you, earn your living through right livelihood, and contribute to the benefit of society in general or to specific individuals in it. You will have to determine a good balance of time and energy given your own situation. So he's not trying to prescribe, you know, what's going to be good for everybody. Okay, but he's saying you have to live in a balanced way. This applies for monastics too. Maintain a daily meditation practice of whatever length is practical and earn your living through right livelihood. Yeah, and contribute to the benefit of society. So that's very good practice, very good advice, you know, that we should remember when people ask us, how can I as a layperson practice the Dharma? We need education to help others most effectively. The purpose of education is not just to learn more about the world or the living beings in it. It is to build a happier human community and to benefit animals as well. Okay. He just gave a totally revolutionary idea or motivation for going to school or for teaching school. Yeah? The purpose of education is not to learn more about the world or the living beings in it. It is to build a happier human community and to benefit animals as well. So this should be our motivation for establishing schools, for teaching in schools, for attending school. With that motivation, study whatever field interests you and seek employment that does not involve harming others or living unethically. In this way, right from the beginning, your whole life will be involved in benefiting others. So I think now, people who have joined certain departments in the present government and have sacrificed their own ethical code to do what has been expected of them. Yeah, or what has been ordered of them. and how important it is as a Buddhist practitioner to not do that. Yeah. And to really hold our ethical conduct very high and very precious. And if a job entails contradicting your values, you leave the job. Yeah. Now, I know people go, but if I quit, I may not have a job. And then by Tuesday, I'll be on the streets, you know. I think don't get so hysterical about it, but just think, you know, what is more important to you as a living being, your ethical values or making money? When you die, what are you going to be thinking about? Oh, I wish I could have made more money. You're not going to think about that when you're dying. But you might think, I wish I had kept my ethical conduct better. Yeah. So very important to live according to our ethical conduct. I was teaching in one place and somebody was asking me, well, they were telling me first that their boss basically, not in so many words, but basically told them that they had to lie to clients. Yeah, we have to close the deal. So you just fudge. You just fudge and get the person to sign on. And it may not be true, but it's for the benefit of the company. And, you know, your boss is telling you to do that. And this person felt very, very conflicted about it. You know, I don't want to lie. I don't want to deceive anybody. What should I do? And I said, quit your job. And she was like, I felt in the audience, this was in Singapore, you know, the idea of quitting your job in Singapore. I mean, you might as well be praying to go to hell. You know, that's what it means there. There was this ripple through the audience. Quit my job. And I said, yeah, it's okay. You know, if you don't feel comfortable, if your employer is telling you to do something ethical, you leave. Unethical, yes, thank you. If your employer is telling you to do something unethical that they're telling you is ethical, you say, bye-bye, you know. And that's what's going on a lot now. It's so interesting. It's so sad, actually. So sad. Okay, in this way, yeah, so you seek employment that does not involve harming others or living unethically. In this way, right from the beginning, your whole life will be involved in benefiting others. I see three ways the Buddhist community can serve society. First, we can be more active in projects that directly benefit others. Dharma centers and monasteries can either set up their own projects or participate in already existing organizations that can help the homeless, provide hospice care for the terminally ill, educate children, reach out to refugees, counsel prisoners, provide health care and food to the poor, protect endangered species, care for the environment, and so on. And so we try and do that here. You know, two of the nuns are on the board of directors of Youth Emergency Services, a local organization for homeless kids. And we have a big prison outreach project, visiting prisoners, corresponding with them, sending them books. People, you know, we get so many requests around the area to come and talk in schools and hospitals, palliative care centers, all sorts of things. And, you know, so joining in with others is who do these works and helping in their organizations is very good. We're too small to start our own social Well, Phil, we're just trying to, you know, we're few in number right now. We can't do that. But one year I was staying, actually twice I've been, and this year too, we're going to Tanxiang Temple in Penang. And it's a huge temple, but they have a building right next to the temple and monastery. And on one floor, they have an old folks home. On another floor, they have a daycare center. And years ago, I stayed there overnight. And so in the morning, I went and I visited these places. And it was so lovely because they had the little kids coming down and visiting the old folks. And the little kids were bringing so much joy to the old folks, you know. And this temple, yet they had a whole enormous building, yeah, dedicated to this social welfare project where they did this for the little kids and the elderly. And it was beautiful. When I first got sent to Singapore, I stayed in a temple that was also an old folks home, yeah. And so, you know, there was the temple and they had temple activities. And then there was an old folks home. And it was so sweet because in the evening they would wheel or all the old folks down to the bottom floor and then lead them in chanting. So they would all chant Namo Amitofo or take refuge. And it was really lovely, you know. They had a Dharma community. They created merit and purified and, you know, it was very sweet, you know. And the same nun who did that, she later built this immense Buddhist center, the Taipei Buddhist Center, and a huge place where they had all sorts of activities and various Buddhist groups could go and rent the different rooms and so on. So it was lovely, you know, in that part of the world where you have so many Buddhists in your society, then you can do all these kinds of things because there's a lot of people, there's a lot of resources. Yeah. His Holiness is always encouraging the Tibetan Buddhist community to be more active in society. Yeah. Okay. So he says, some centers are already engaged in such work, and I am very pleased with this. I think also on the BBCs that we do give, we talk about current issue. We talk issues. We talk about the climate crisis. You know, we talk about different things in society, try and give people help how to live in the craziness of that the world is in now. Okay, His Holiness continues, Baba Amte, who lived 1914 to 2008, a follower of Mahatma Gandhi and an Indian social worker, established an ashram for thousands of lepers who are ordinarily neglected by society and trained them in various skills. When I saw them working with tools, I was concerned that they would hurt themselves. But the lepers worked diligently and with self-confidence. I offered part of the money for my Nobel Peace Prize to this ashram. And one Italian woman set up a home for lepers outside of Bogaya. Yeah. I have also met residents of a slum in a large Indian city. He went to Mumbai, yeah. And there, some people have a special project to help the people in one of the slums. Since the people were from a low caste, they felt demoralized. If we treat them with kindness, respecting them as human beings like us, they feel more confident. Once, some laborers were repairing my residence in Dharamsala. At first, they were shy and timid, but when I shook their hands and chatted with them, they smiled and laughed. Yeah, they were probably so shocked because a lot of the people who do construction in India are, you know, lower caste people. And His Holiness coming up and shaking their hands. Yeah, it's a big thing. We should not think that we are special and look down on others. We have been in that situation in past lives and may be in future lives if we act recklessly now. Yeah, so don't hold yourself superior to others. We should also help individuals directly. Often there are many severely disabled beggars outside the monasteries where I teach in India. Some of them drag themselves on the ground. I feel very sad looking at them and encourage people who attend teachings to help them. Yeah, he did that at Tashi Lumpo. Yeah, when he was teaching there. And there were beggars all down the line. And he was really talking about some of the ones who were very severely disabled. Yeah, and encouraging everybody to help them out. Second, we can use Buddhist principles and techniques to promote compassion, altruism, self-confidence, fearlessness, fortitude, and tolerance in society. Many concepts and techniques found in Buddhism for working with the mind can help others, both secular people and those of other faiths. Social activists may want to learn methods to overcome anger. Teachers may want to introduce exercises to cultivate empathy, compassion, and good communication among students. We should explain these methods to others in a secular setting without speaking about Buddhist doctrine or encouraging people to become Buddhist. So he's very clear, we are not to try and convert people. Childhood is a crucial time, yet many children grow up in an atmosphere with little compassion. Their parents quarrel and divorce. Their teachers do not care for them as individuals. When these children become adults and act without conscience or compassion, who can blame them? They never experience deeper human affection. The Buddhist community can make significant contributions in schools and families by helping people build families with more warmth and affection, and by showing teachers how to be involved, patient, and compassionate with their students. Parents and teachers and society in general need to learn that teaching children to be good human beings is more important than helping them become rich or famous. Third, we can present Buddhist ideas and practices to help those who are interested. Someone who is terminally ill may want to hear about rebirth. Healthcare professionals may be interested in the stages of dying as described in Buddhist texts. Buddhist teachers may help young people who are spiritually lost, and teaching Buddha nature and compassion to the incarcerated can give them a new vision of life. Okay, so really reaching out, teaching the Dharma to people who are interested. So we get a lot of invitations to do that. And the UU group has been going for what, 10 years? 12. Yeah. So that's quite amazing, you know, 12 years. And really seeing the people change. Representatives from various Buddhist groups could meet to consider taking a united stand on some issues. Actually, there's been some discussion of this. I have one friend on the East Coast who's quite interested in establishing some kind of Buddhist organization where we could take a stand on certain social issues. When Trump was banning different people from entering the country, and when he was putting children in cages, we got a petition from It started with one Buddhist group in the Bay Area asking for Buddhist groups or Buddhist teachers to sign on for that kind of thing. There's been one case of sexual abuse, one allegation of sexual abuse in the tradition. And, you know, we started a petition to get people to advocate for an independent investigation, which hasn't happened yet, but we're trying. You know, so doing things that can really, you know, work together with various Buddhist groups and Buddhist individuals to do things that really help society in general. Okay, so His Holiness says, in that way, Buddhists can participate with concerted effort to preserve the environment and protect the beings in it, including animals. Okay, so all of us working together and presenting a common front. In our world, many life forms that do not create problems are sacrificed to serve the purpose of human beings who are the troublemakers. We cannot change these things at once, but it is worthwhile to voice our concerns and do whatever is possible. Should we go on for another page, or are you fading? Yeah, you're okay? Okay. Some people believe that religious practice and political involvement are contradictory, and that a truly spiritual person should not be involved in politics. So I have been criticized because of making statements about different social issues, not telling people who to vote for, but, you know, talking about events in the public sphere. And a few people have written and said, you're a Buddhist nun, you should not be talking about politics. Yeah. But I think that as citizens of a country, yeah, we need to talk about politics. You know, we don't tell people what to believe, but we bring up ethical issues. And ethical issues are directly related to politics. Yeah. When we watched one webinar, you know, about the law and what you can do as a religious organization. So you cannot tell people who to vote for, although many Christian congregations, the pastor does do that. Legally, you're not supposed to do that. But the guy who ran the attorney who taught the webinar said, but religious people, you know, have a lot to contribute in terms of helping people see the correct ethical perspective on different issues. And he said, you must speak out about those. Don't be quiet about those. So about policy, you know, we can talk all we want, yeah, related to specific policies and applying the Dharma to those policies.
Mm-hmm. Put it in context, just to mention that the people sponsoring the seminar was one of the major insurance companies that insures churches in this country.
Yeah.
And this was their advice to be involved.
Yeah.
And to do it correctly. And then the other thing is, even this is for some of the laws have to do if you're a there are some parts that are of nonprofits that, you know, they have certain restrictions, but there's other parts where you don't take any tax deductions, where you can be involved in politics in a different way, but they're not like, 501c3. So that's we're more restricted because of that. But there's other ways that organizations who have church affiliation and other political affiliations can make statements.
Yeah, they incorporate under a different tax structure. Yeah. Okay. What? Okay. So several factors must be taken into consideration here about religious people being involved in political activities. Okay. Although politics itself is not inherently corrupt or evil, a person's motivation can make it so. A person using politics to convert people to his religion or impose beliefs unique to his religion on all of society lacks respect for all beings. And this is something that I'm fearing could happen in this country, you know, with the religious right and their influence on different laws that have to do with social policy, you know, where their particular view is being imposed on all of society. Yeah. That's being done in the name of religious freedom, but I don't think it is. Okay. However, a person using, okay, so again, using politics to convert people to your own religion or impose beliefs, we should not be doing that. However, political action taken with a compassionate motivation can be another method to solve human problems, just as engineering, teaching, farming, healthcare, and factory work can benefit humanity. Okay, so we look, I mean, some of the greatest leaders that we've seen have been in politics have been religious leaders. I mean, Martin Luther King, for one, you know, and how was he able to affect so many people because of, you know, his religious beliefs? You look at Elijah Cummings, yeah, and he wasn't a preacher, but his, you know, religion was, you know, his real bedrock. And everything he did as a member of, as a representative in the House, reflected his, the ethical standards and his religious beliefs, such that, you know, at his funeral, some of us watched many of the eulogies. I mean, this is where he really shone and what people remembered him for. It is especially important for politicians to behave ethically and develop compassion. Please, may they hear that. May they do that. Oh, my goodness. And their personal spiritual practice may help them to do so. Example, Elijah Cummings. Okay. I sometimes tell Indian politicians that they should be genuinely religious, not like Modi is being right now, which is encouraging Hindu nationalism. Okay, politicians should be genuinely religious because their actions have a strong effect on society. If a hermit in the mountains lacks proper ethical restraint, few people are harmed. But if a politician does, an entire nation and even the world can be adversely affected. And I think that's what is happening now, unfortunately, and why it's so important for us to hold good ethical standards and to hold the leaders in society to good ethical standards and not just say, well, that's what politicians do. They're going to do it anyway, so I'll just forget it. No, you know, they should hold good, they're the leaders that people look up to, and they should act properly, you know, and speak properly and not harm other living beings. In the precious garland which Nagarjuna wrote for the Satavahana king, he penned many verses with instructions on how to govern effectively and fairly. Here are some examples. And due to Venerable Nima's kindness, I have a whole talk that I give on this topic that people love. Yeah. So here's from Nagarjuna. At that time, and he's giving this teaching to the king, at that time, as a ruler, you should internalize firmly the practices of generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude that were especially taught for householders and have as their essence compassion. Just as you are intent on thinking of what could be done to help yourself, so you should be intent on thinking of what could be done to help others. Can I send this to the White House? Just as by themselves the true words of kings generate firm trust, so their false words are the best means to create distrust. We have a perfect example now, don't we? Yeah. Nagarjuna also encouraged the king to tax citizens fairly. Okay, so don't give the wealthy and the corporations tax breaks and make the middle class bear the burden. Okay, so he encouraged the king to tax citizens fairly, fund a system of public education that ensures teachers are well compensated. Chicago teachers were just on strike. The strike, I think, just ended. Yeah. Gotta take care of teachers. Okay. And construct public roads with rest stops and parks where people can relax and enjoy themselves. We were supposed to have a big infrastructure bill. Hasn't happened. Remember, that was one of the things. In recent years, many people have turned to Buddhist scriptures for guidance on current issues. Other people have sought confirmation of their political or social views in the Buddha Dharma. Quotations to support this or that view may certainly be found in the scriptures. However, we must be open-minded and avoid thinking that everyone who calls themselves a Buddhist should agree on all political and social issues. The Buddha principally taught the path to liberation from cyclic existence. When he gave advice on social, family, political, and other issues, he spoke in the context of Indian culture of the 5th century BCE. Some, but not all, of this advice can be applied and adapted to present contexts. So we should not make people feel obliged that they should hold particular political or social views. Some people regard the Tibet issue as political, and as Dharma practitioners, they do not want to get involved. However, if we want Tibetan Buddhism to flourish and remain in our world, we need freedom in Tibet. Without having autonomy in our country, we Tibetans will have great difficulty in preserving our form of Buddha Dharma. This, in turn, will adversely impact the rest of the world. Although I do not expect all Dharma practitioners to actively work for human rights and freedom in Tibet, your sympathy and moral support does have an effect. Okay, so talking to people about that, even when we're asked to give public talks, we had on Monday, there was a high school class that came here. And so they wanted to hear about Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism and all. And so I'd also talked about how communist China invaded Tibet and how the Tibetans became refugees. You know, these kids had probably never heard that before. It planted some seeds, you know, so that they'll know. Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions, comments.
In thinking about your presentation of how not to talk about self-love or self-compassion as a teaching of the Buddha in terms of explicitly, mm-hmm. And how sometimes I've heard it talked about how renunciation or the determination to be free can be seen as self-love or self-compassion. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with presenting it that way? Or
yes. His Holiness does not present it that way, but some of us Westerners do, because, you know, renunciation and the determination to be free is wishing, aspiring for yourself to attain nirvana, okay? And the definition of compassion is wanting somebody to be free of suffering. So it fits that definition, okay? Yeah, and I think it can be very skillful, because talking about self-compassion is very popular in society nowadays, and it could get people to think more broadly about what compassion for yourself really means. Okay, so it doesn't just mean, you know, kind of forgiving your own mistakes and so forth, but it actually means wishing yourself to be free of suffering. And if you want to be free of suffering, you know, the best way to do that is to practice the Dharma and eliminate self-grasping ignorance.
More about that subject, the steps in the meditation, mm-hmm. it begins with generating love for oneself. And I notice it doesn't track the sutta, but those steps are traditionally practiced.
No, the traditional practice is it starts with somebody that you respect. A lot of the Western teachers have started it off with generating compassion for yourself. But that's not how Buddha Gosa taught it.
And then there's a question online. How do you respond to and offer direction to someone who has watched a BBC and seen the political issues presented and now says that Venerable should be disrobed and has failed Buddhism?
And has failed what?
Buddhism.
What do you say to that person? Please explain to me why you think that. Yeah. And then see, you know, don't argue with them. But it could be interesting to, you know, to hear why somebody says that. And it could be interesting to find out what the teacher said, you know. Because they said that the teacher was talking about a political issue. Were they talking about me?
Yes, I believe so. Oh, BBC. Really? Someone who has watched a BBC.
BBC, oh, and said that, oh, Venerable, that I should be disrobed, yes, because I talked about a political issue.
Yeah.
You're welcome to your own opinion. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just think about what His Holiness said here. Because, you see, some people have the idea that if, you know, you're a spiritual person, you should not be involved in, you should only be involved in prayer and meditation and so on. Yeah, some people have that idea. Other people, like me, think that you should be able to apply your spiritual principles and ethical principles to the world. Yeah. So that's what I try to do. I think if I were yelling and screaming and insulting people and calling them names and telling other people who to vote for, they're, you know, what they said would, you know, I should listen. But this, it's just their opinion.
Well, I don't know if this came from one of our Singaporean friends or if it came from an American, but it's very hard for me to imagine. This whole country has been built on the preachers of all kinds, on all sides, declaring what's to be done politically, and the political leaders following different spiritual beliefs and proclaiming them from the street corners and the rooftops. So why the heck a Buddhist couldn't, when the Christians have been for all these years, I don't get.
Because it's different. Yeah, you're only allowed to espouse the views of one religion. Yeah.
One more question online. Should we start to develop love and compassion for ourselves before we develop it for others?
It depends where you are in your practice. Yeah. If you feel comfortable starting with others, go right ahead. If you feel that you need to learn how to forgive yourself or how to accept yourself, then meditate on love and compassion for yourself, but also meditate on love and compassion for others. If you do it just for yourself, you're going to be very unbalanced. Yes, you have to make sure that you do it for others as well. Okay, but self-acceptance is very, very important. You know, forgiving ourselves is very important. So, you know, we need to do that. But, you know, this, a lot of that comes under purification, doesn't it? You know? So you can teach if somebody, you know, needs to forgive themselves, you can teach self-love, but you can also teach purification practice. And because the two really come together, don't they? You know, we have to forgive ourselves. Have some tolerance and acceptance for ourselves.
Wanted to comment that where you started tonight, where you're in tonight, come to a similar point where you were starting tonight. You were talking about imagining ourselves, in a sense, as having the potential to become a Buddha. Mm-hmm. And when we do the 35 Buddha practice, there, you know, after the end of it, you take a time to imagine yourself with all these qualities of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think that comes to the point that you're talking about self-love, self-acceptance, because yeah. You, in that mind there, I mean, you can watch your mind. Like, when you can imagine that, your mind is so peaceful, that you mm-hmm. can kind of even like, oh, okay, maybe. But when your mind is all afflicted and you haven't really been able to clear the thing out, you hardly can get your mind to even go that yeah. direction. So it's really a really nice tool
yeah.
to help us to learn a healthy way to think of ourselves yeah. in a very positive light.
Yeah. So you can see that these meditations, you know, visualizing the Buddha in front and the light coming and purifying and bringing the realizations and all, those are meditations, if you're going to put them in psychological terms, designed to develop self-confidence and self-love, you know, and to clear away obscurations to seeing our potential. So that would be a Buddhist way to work on those same issues.
I think the question you posed around, like, how is it that when we call ourselves religious practitioners, but when culture comes up against that, some kind of veil seems to happen. Mm-hmm. I was listening to a talk by Sister Helen Prejean. I think she said, it's only the last pope, I think, that made a very clear stand for the Catholic Church against the death penalty.
Yep.
Yeah. And too, we see in Buddhist countries that don't say anything about, you know, Buddhist practitioners who seem to have no issue with the death penalty. It's like such a clear fundamental tenet in all religions to value life. So she compared it to how the UN has already spelled out clear declarations on human rights. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was comparing the position of the church to that secular political position.
Yeah, yeah, it's very interesting how you talk about human rights and religion, which usually talks about equanimity and love and compassion, sometimes, I mean, don't practice human rights. Religious institutions sometimes are the most conservative in society. Yeah. And I was very surprised when I was in Singapore, you know, one of the Dharma students, because they have laws, you have for bringing drugs into the country, you face the death penalty. You know, it's a nonviolent crime, but they will kill you for it. And I was shocked to hear, you know, some Buddhists say, "Yeah, that's fine," you know, and they never questioned it. And then, of course, I said, "Excuse me, you know, what's our first precept?" And how do you apply this precept to, you know, to what you see around you? Yeah, I'll have to check with him when I see him this year. What what he thinks.
When one religion or one sect of religion gets power in, like, to where that's the only thing that can be practiced, that group will find themselves being dominated by politicians.
Oh, yeah.
The politicians will get power, and then they won't have freedom either. Yeah. Yeah, you can't have freedom of one religion.
Yeah, well, all through, at least in Western civilization, the link between church and state and how they reinforce each other's power has been very, very strong. When you study history, they're completely intermixed. And this is how religious institutions get corrupted. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 But what was interesting in Tibet is they wanted to have a religious leader as their head. Or at least some people did. Some people in the other Buddhist sects didn't particularly like that. But many people, because they thought, oh, a religious leader will keep better ethical conduct. But there was a lot of corruption in the Tibetan government, too.
Yes, that they use each other in a way. Like in that instance, what I understood, either at least from, I think it was Matthew Kapstein's book, you know, he's a historian, that about that area of the world. And it seemed to me that, like, the emperor of one country would court the ruling religious class in Tibet so that they could have more power, like in China or in Mongolia, or because they were actually trying to triangulate this area of land that was between them all, that was kind of like a frontier that nobody really had enough resources to control fully. So they just kind of did it through political religious connections.
Yeah. Well, what you had in Tibetan history is when the Tibetans were fighting each other, not necessarily as political, as religious groups, but as different political or area groups from different areas of Tibet. When they were fighting each other for political power, they would go to different groups of the Mongols for support. Yeah? So you invited a foreign power into your government. Yeah, to influence who has political power, and different groups invited different people from different countries. Yeah. So, I mean, human beings are human beings. It doesn't matter what religion. Yeah. And thank goodness, I mean, the Buddhists, some people think, oh, the Buddhists never had wars or stuff like that. That's not true. But we had fewer wars, yeah, and I think fewer killings in the name of Buddhism than other religions.
Also, our prison data is like that, too. In the United States, in the prisons, when they rank the violence amongst inmates, the Buddhists are the lowest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.